Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. My guest today is Elizabeth Dunbar. She's the executive director of the Everson Museum of Art, located in downtown Syracuse. The museum is celebrating its 50th anniversary. Elizabeth, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Well, when we last spoke, and it was 4 years ago, and I can't believe it was 4 years ago, the museum was beginning to emerge from a financial crisis that had, at that time at least, caused some cancellations of planned exhibitions. It limited the staff and even, according to some accounts, cast uncertainty on the very future of the museum. So first question, obviously, is, you know, how have things gone since then? Where does the museum stand now in those terms?
Well, I'd say we're in a very different place than we were 4 years ago. Things have changed dramatically, and for the positive. The museum, I would say, is thriving at this point. We have grown our programs. We've grown our staff. We've grown our budget. As you mentioned, are celebrating our 50th anniversary of our building. We, in conjunction with that, we've launched a comprehensive campaign with a goal of $17 million, and we're a good two-thirds of the way towards that goal. And we continue to expand in many different ways in our programs, in our ambitions, improvements in the building. So things are going swimmingly.
It sounds like it. So where did the money that you needed back then come from? Who were the angels that came to the
angels
rescue?
Well, I'd say the angels were the people among us, quite frankly, the people that you never expected to be angels. I would say, first and foremost, our board of trustees really stepped up. I joined the organization in late 2014, December 2014. And that first year, of course, was, challenging, working with a very limited budget. The budget has since increased incrementally over the last four plus years. But that first year, really, we had a lot of people dig deep in their pockets, our board of trustees, local foundations. We had a lot of supporters that really came out to help us turn the tide and invest in different things to get us mobilized and moving in the right direction.
Was there a sense that it simply wouldn't be acceptable for the city, and given some of the other problems that the city was facing at that time too, to lose the art museum? I mean, the city did, in a sense, lose the symphony, and they have now another version of it back, but they did go through that. How can you sort of take me back to that time and what that sense was like?
Sure. Well, you know, I came here from Houston, so I did not experience the folding of the symphony firsthand. But of course, coming here, I heard quite a lot about it early on. And I think there was a sense that this was a cultural treasure that, you know, really we needed to fight for it. And I think we had the right people on the board at the right time who were really, I mean, they had to make some very difficult decisions before I came in, and built consensus within the board and with a core group of people to move the institution forward. It was a difficult time, no doubt, but I think people truly believed that it was worth saving, that, you know, for this institution to move forward, for the city to move forward, that we needed to do something. And they were tremendous in their efforts to really get other people to support the institution. And I think there were people sitting in the background who were waiting to see who would step up to the plate. And once a few people did, and major players did, it began to roll into place.
Right. Others, critical mass.
Yeah. I mean, I think there were some foundations or were waiting to see who the next leader would be, what the vision for the future would be. And once they felt comfortable with those initial steps, they, you know, put a serious investment into the institution to help spur the growth forward.
I remember when we were talking back then, the museum was trying to engage social media more effectively. And also there was a focus, or at least an increase in the focus, let's say, on the smaller donations as a way to try to get some traction. How did those things work?
Well, I think it's been successful for us. We've taken a real grassroots approach to how we do business at the museum. It's no longer big blockbuster shows where you pay your, you know, $20 to get in once every 3 to 4, 5 years when those blockbusters arrive. No, now it is building membership. It's coming repeatedly. We're changing the exhibitions, you know. We do 20-plus exhibitions annually now. So there's always something different to see. We've, you know, expanded our programming offerings exponentially, as I said. And again, you know, getting people to return over and over and over. So sometimes it's those $50 memberships or the annual appeal at the end of the year. Even though you're a $75 member, you might give us that extra $100 at the end of the year as a charitable donation. And those are the investments that make this museum, you know, embedded in the fabric of the community.
And you mentioned the significant capital campaign that you've got going on now with a goal of $17 million, two-thirds of the way through that. That sounds great. Tell me more about that campaign. What is it tied to? You know, what are its aspects?
Right. Well, it's the biggest, the most ambitious fundraising campaign in the museum's history. You know, we launched it in conjunction with the 50th anniversary celebration. And it's tied to a number of different investments initiatives into the museum, one being capital improvements. We have a, you know, architectural masterpiece here in Syracuse, the I.M. Pace First Museum building. And we need to put some serious investment into the building itself. It's a work of art, a sculpture, if you will, sitting within the plaza. And it requires the upkeep and maintenance and preservation that you would apply to any work of art. So trying to continually invest in the building, we just finished a $1.3 million complete renovation of our auditorium. This next year, we will be embarking on the renovation of our cafe. We're doing an international design competition in conjunction with that. So investments into the building itself. Secondly, to grow our endowment. The Everson's endowment is very modest for a museum its size, its scale within the community, the number of programs that we offer. So we really need to double our endowment, if not more. That helps make us sustainable. And then the third component is to invest in capacity building initiatives, enabling us to grow our education programs, putting dollars into investing in staff so we can continue to grow.
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Elizabeth Dunbar, Executive Director of the Everson Museum of Art in Syracuse. So it's the 50th anniversary. 50 years is a big milestone. The capital campaign is tied to that. That's one thing. How else has the museum been celebrating this marker or intends to celebrate it?
Well, we've had a number of new programs and exhibitions that are tied to the 50th anniversary. We launched, of course, with a big gala event back in September, but we have a year-long celebration in place. We are going to have a number of exhibitions that have a historical component to them or relate to the building or those folks who have maybe launched their careers or had substantial careers that really started at the museum. So our first exhibition this past fall was on the building itself. It's how it came to be following it started out as the Syracuse Museum of Fine Arts, so it really traced the history of the Everson's origins and evolution. And that's followed up by coming up in February, opening to the public February 9th. It are two exhibitions, Suzanne Anker, one by Frank Gillette. And Frank Gillette is an artist who has shown at the Everson. This will be his third time to show. His first exhibition was in 1973. He is a video artist. And, the Everson is considered the epicenter for video art, having established the first video art department back in the 1970s and starting a video collection. So Frank is affiliated with that. We'll have more exhibitions that touch on our history, including this fall, which I'm very pleased to announce here, an exhibition with the artist Yoko Ono,
oh, wow.
Who initially showed at the Everson in 1971. It was her very first museum exhibition, so we're welcoming her back. And you know, that's something we're very proud of at the Everson, as being a launching pad for artists. We've had a number who have gone on to very important careers, including I.M. Pei.
That's right. You gave him a start.
That's right.
So, you know, 50 years, the fact of 50 years, it got me thinking about another question that I asked you 4 years ago. But thinking back now, 1968, the city of Syracuse was arguably a much more vibrant place in a lot of ways than it is now. I mean, it had 50,000 more people in population, among other things. But there have been some recent signs of, I think, hope and positive things in the city and in the downtown. I was just wondering, though, have you undertaken any specifically suburban-focused initiatives? I'm not even sure what that would look like for an art museum, but has there been any conversation about, you know, what specifically do we need to do to bring the suburbs into this?
Well, I'd say for our programming in general, we hope to appeal to a very broad audience. We would love for everyone to visit us downtown. I mean, that's our, you know, number for first and foremost. We want to be the center for culture downtown and to contribute to the revitalization of downtown and travel and tourism and all the things that come along with that. That said, we recognize not everyone can get downtown or, you know, for various reasons. We have a very active outreach program. So if you are unable to come to the museum, we go to retirement centers, senior centers, libraries, all over the place, and work with different groups to take our exhibitions to them and do art making activities as well. So we try to work out in the suburbs, and we, you know, are going as far as Oswego and other places in order to reach audiences there. There are kids that can't get here because school kids that can't get to us because of bus funding limitations. So we go to them. So any way we can reach an audience, of course, online is another way that we're able to do that. We've had exhibitions that you can, you know, we've been able to take kind of virtual reality tours of our exhibitions, so you can see them from your handheld device or on your laptop, if you like. But also we have pretty robust content that we want to share with our audience as well.
You're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with Elizabeth Dunbar. She's the executive director of the Everson Museum of Art in Syracuse. The museum has been celebrating its 50th year, and Elizabeth is beginning her fifth year as executive director. So you mentioned some of the exhibits that you've got going on related to the 50th anniversary, and there's a lot of interesting ones. When I was looking through, there's quite a large number that are currently on display right now. And I imagine this is sort of like picking favorite children, but, you know, give me a couple that you haven't mentioned that you think are particularly important or particularly interesting, and tell me more about them.
Oh, gosh. Well, yeah, it is. It's difficult to pick a favorite. We've done so many. I think in the 4 years that I've been here, we've had close to 100 shows.
Well,
so
the ones that are going on right now,
yeah.
the ones that people can see right now, which ones sort of leap out at you? I mean, well, go ahead. I'll turn it over.
Let me talk about one that's on view now. It's just been
sure.
open for a few weeks. It's titled Hidden Figures. It's a ceramics exhibition. And as part of our 50th anniversary celebration and our comprehensive campaign, we were able to hire a ceramics curator, the first time we've had a ceramics curator in decades. And, of course, the Everson has one of the premier collections of ceramic arts, being a longtime collector of ceramics since the early, well, I guess our first acquisition of ceramic was 1916 with the purchase of 32 porcelains by famed arts and crafts ceramist Adelaide Robineau. With the scarab vase came a little bit later, but
I want to ask you about
yeah.
that vase in a minute. But go
sure,
ahead, keep
yeah.
going. I want to come back
so
to that.
So, we managed to draw our curator, Garth Johnson, from Tempe, Arizona, lured him here to the sandy shores of Syracuse.
Well, they got you from Texas.
I know. So we both have big lights in our office to keep us get some sunlight. But in any case, we lured him here, really the preeminent curator of ceramics in the country right now, to come and work with us, which he was, you know, thrilled to be able to do that, to work with this storied collection. And so he has put together a very interesting exhibition of ceramics from 1932 to 1972 that explore the figurative tradition in ceramic sculpture. So I would definitely recommend seeing that. It's in our ceramics gallery, which was recently renovated. It's just about 2 years old. And we will be dedicating the space later this month, on February 28th, actually. It will be renamed the Paul Phillips and Sharon Sullivan Center for Ceramics, Ceramic Center, rather. Hmm. And Paul and Sharon have given almost $5 million to our campaign in support of our ceramics efforts.
And I read that vase that you just mentioned.
Yeah.
Is worth over $1 million?
I think it's priceless. I don't know if we could actually put a number on it.
But
it's definitely, you know, one of the most treasured objects in our collection. It is considered the Mona Lisa of ceramics. We have people from...
Do you get nervous anytime it gets moved? Like, you know, you don't want to be in the building or you...
I've touched it. I think that's a rite of passage for every director or curator on staff at the Everson. We get to touch the scarab vase with gloved hands, of course.
Right.
But, it is. We have people from all over the world that travel specifically to the Everson Museum to see the scarab vase.
Well, one of the ones that I was particularly struck by, and I'm curious to hear about this from you, was, I've got the name right, but the regeneration.
Yes.
Exhibit.
Yes.
And that runs, I think, until the 24th of this month.
Absolutely,
so
right.
Time will be running short for people listening to this, but they'll still have a good couple of weeks or so. Tell me more about that one.
So the Regeneration Show is part of an exhibition series we started about a year and a half ago, of community exhibitions. So we invite the public to submit a proposal for an exhibition. It has to be a group show. And this was one of the winning proposals, and they're women over the age of 65, women artists over the age of 65, some who are amateur artists, some who are professional artists, but all of whom have really exceptional talent. A number of them are docents or volunteers with the museum, so it's really wonderful to, you know, I see them giving tours to school children and to adults and leading workshops, but it's really great to be able to see their work up on the walls of the museum, and it's brought in a lot of people to see their work as well.
If you just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media, and my guest is Everson Museum of Art Executive Director Elizabeth Dunbar. All right, so we're talking on the day after the President's State of the Union address, and you are talking about an exhibition focused on the art of women. So obviously my thoughts turn to politics here. I don't know if that particular exhibit could be seen through a political lens, but nonetheless, our political sphere has become just so extremely polarized in recent years. And I imagine that you have to think about that when you are making decisions about exhibitions or individual works of art. I was just wondering if you could relate how those conversations take place. I mean, what you consider, what do you make a point of saying, we're not going to consider this and we're just going to act as if this was not an issue? I mean, how do you sort it out?
Well, I think the museum is, you know, speaking as a museum professional, the museum has historically been a space for all cultures, hopefully, to meet in and be able to learn from one another and see the world through the eyes of someone else. You may not agree with their point of view. You may not share their, you know, values or belief systems, but it is a space where we all feel we can get together and view work together, and it's an important experience to have. From a curatorial standpoint, in terms of our programming, we want to really show a range of work that's being made. We're not only going to show, you know, works by women artists. We're not going to show just work by a male artist from a particular part of the country. No, we try to come up with a very varied exhibition schedule. You know, historical work versus more contemporary work, different, you know, ideas and issues that they're grappling with. But I would say for the most part, they're, you know, most of the, I mean, some are provocative, some are less provocative. Mm. Some are more aesthetic explorations, and others are more political or sociopolitical explorations.
And I think many of our listeners may not realize this about the museum. And I think I've got this right. You correct me if I'm wrong. The museum was founded to solely focus on American art, right?
It was
the first museum to do that, no?
Yeah, well, we were founded in 1897 as the Syracuse Museum of Fine Arts. It wasn't until the early 1900s, so not, you know, about a decade later, that they decided to focus on collecting American art. They continued to exhibit non-American, but really the focus has been American art.
I was just wondering if there was any tension regarding that focus. Again, I'm thinking about politics. I'm a political scientist, but in our recent political times, you know, any is there any discussion about, you know, we need to make a point of bringing in art that's not American, or, you know?
Well, I think American can be defined rather broadly. Mm-hmm. Are we talking about the United States of America? Are we talking about North America, mm-hmm. South America?
Okay.
We can interpret that broadly. On the other hand, our ceramics collection is global and encyclopedic, so, you know, from antiquity to the present. So we have a little more flexibility in that area. But if you're living in the United States, you're not necessarily American, but it's made in America. So maybe, you know, we use that term as loosely as we need to.
And I mentioned earlier in passing that you came here from Texas and this area was new to you when you arrived. Have you discovered anything different here in Syracuse relative to other areas with which you're familiar about the relationship of art to the city and of art to the region in terms of economic development or in terms of culture more generally? What has struck you?
Well, one thing was interesting to me in, you know, this is different, I think, than other places that I've lived. I don't know if it's so specific to the art, but I'm seeing it through the lens of art in a way. We just dedicated our education center. It's the Daniel Family Education Center. And the Daniels are a young couple here in the area. Jessica Daniel is our new president of the Board of Trustees. Her husband, Patrick, is a co-owner of Terrakeet, which is a company downtown. And they're young. They have two young children, and they gave a substantial donation to the museum for the education center. And not only did they give money, they encouraged many of their friends and family to do the same, to support the education center. And these are a lot of young families, and, you know, the parents are in their 30s or early 40s. And many of them have grown up here in the area, moved away to D.C., to Boston, to New York, to L.A., Chicago, major cities around the country to get professional degrees, you know, get careers. And then they return here to raise a family, and they want to invest in this community. They want this community to be here for their children, to have the sorts of cultural activities and entertainment and robust quality of life that they've seen in other places. And so they're investing in places like the museum. So thanks to Jessica and Patrick, they reached out to a lot of people, but they got about, I think, 11 families, many of whom are from this area, to contribute another $87,000 towards this education center. And for many folks, these are young philanthropists in the making. It's the first big gift that they've ever made to a charitable organization. So we see that investment back into the community, back into downtown. And I think it's a very positive way to look at the city.
We've just got a couple minutes left, but I want to squeeze a couple of sort of funner questions in, I guess. One of the other things that caught my eye was the city sketch Crawl, which I guess is coming up in the spring. Mm-hmm. So tell me about that briefly, and then I have one last question about the museum I want to ask you.
Sure. Well, the City Sketch Crawl is something that we've offered a few times now. It's one of our many activities, public programs that we offer to the community, trying to get people inside the museum but also outside the museum and participate in a social experience as well as artistic experience. So getting out into the city, sketching the buildings. With the 50th anniversary, we're, focused on architecture a lot for the year. So that's one part of our architecture series. We've had design talks sponsored by the American Institute of Architects, as well as we've had the Women in Architecture lecture series at the museum as well. And another fascinating thing, and I think is really exciting, is we've created architecture kits that we sell them in our museum shop, but we also give them to every fifth grader in the Syracuse City School District. Mm-hmm. And it's an activity book about the museum, about the life of I.M. Pei and the design of our building, along with a build-your-own Everson Museum out of cardboard template, which takes five adults, I think, to put together, but we give them to fifth graders, along with a lot of other great little things. So we provide tours to every fifth grader in the city school district. So we're excited that we can share the love and pride of our building with the larger citizenry.
In just a few seconds left, but I have to ask this question. When you mentioned that there was a part of the capital projects was to improve the building itself or to shore it up. So buildings by Frank Lloyd Wright, are famous for falling down the minute that you put the last brick in. Is that an issue for I.M. Pei as well? Is there like a structural thing that you're always fighting with?
It's a work of art. It is you have to ask our facility manager, really. I mean, that's the right person to talk to. But, we love the building so much. There are days that we absolutely hate that building, too. It's a love-hate relationship. But at the end of the day, truly, we love it. And we're doing all that we can to preserve it for the future. And so many generations to come can enjoy it just as we have.
That was Elizabeth Dunbar. Elizabeth, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with me.
Absolutely. Thank you.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media, Conversations in the Public Interest.
The Campbell Conversations, Conversations in the Public Interest, was hosted and produced by Grant Reher, engineered by Tom Fazio, and edited by Jason Smith. Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program or to hear previous interviews, visit wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations.